John Charrington's Wedding by Edith Nesbit. No one ever thought that May Forster would marry John Charrington, but he thought differently, and things which John Charrington intended had a queer way of coming to pass. He asked her to marry him before he went up to Oxford. She laughed and refused him. He asked her again next time he came home. Again she laughed, tossed her dainty blonde head, and again refused. A third time he asked her. She said it was becoming a confirmed bad habit, and laughed at him more than ever. John was not the only man who wanted to marry her. She was the belle of our village coterie, and we were all in love with her, more or less. It was a sort of fashion, like heliotrope ties or Inverness capes. Therefore, we were as much annoyed as surprised when John Charrington walked into our little club, we held it in a loft over the Saddler's, I remember, and invited us all to his wedding. "Your wedding? You don't mean it. What's the happy pair? When's it to be?" John Charrington filled his pipe and lighted it before he replied. Then he said, "I'm sorry to deprive you fellows of your only joke, but Miss Forster and I are to be married in September." "You don't mean it!" He's got the mitten again, and it's turned his head. "No," I said, rising, "I see it's true. Lend me a pistol, someone, or a first-class fare to the other end of nowhere. Charrington has bewitched the only pretty girl in our 20-mile radius. Was it mesmerism or a love potion, Jack?" "Neither, sir, but a gift you'll never have. Perseverance, and the best luck a man ever had in this world." There was something in his voice that silenced me, and all the chaff of the other fellows failed to draw him further. The queer thing about it was that when we congratulated Miss Forster, she blushed and smiled and dimpled for all the world as though she were in love with him and had been in love with him all the time. Upon my word, I think she had. Women are strange creatures. We were all asked to the wedding. In Brixham, everyone who was anybody knew everybody else who was anyone. My sisters were, I truly believe, more interested in the trousseau than the bride herself, and I was to be best man. The coming marriage was much canvassed at afternoon tea tables and at our little club over the Saddler's, and the question was always asked, "Does she care for him?" I used to ask that question myself in the early days of their engagement, but after a certain evening in August I never asked it again. I was coming home from the club through the churchyard. Our church is on a thyme-grown hill, and the turf about it is so thick and soft that one's footsteps are noiseless. I made no sound as I vaulted the low lichened wall and threaded my way between the tombstones. It was at the same instant that I heard John Charrington's voice and saw her. May was sitting on a low, flat gravestone, her face turned towards the full splendor of the western sun. Its expression ended, at once and forever, any question of love for him. It was transfigured to a beauty I should not have believed possible, even to that beautiful little face. John lay at her feet, and it was his voice that broke the stillness of the golden August evening. "My dear... my dear, I believe I should come back from the dead if you wanted me." I coughed at once to indicate my presence and passed on into the shadow, fully enlightened. The wedding was to be early in September. 2 days before, I had to run up to town on business. The train was late, of course, for we are on the Southeastern, and as I stood grumbling with my watch in my hand, whom should I see but John Charrington and May Forster? They were walking up and down the unfrequented end of the platform, arm in arm, looking into each other's eyes, careless of the sympathetic interest of the porters. Of course, I knew better than to hesitate a moment before burying myself in the booking office, and it was not till the train drew up at the platform that I obtrusively passed the pair with my Gladstone and took the corner in a first-class smoking carriage. I did this with as good an air of not seeing them as I could assume. I pride myself on my discretion, but if John were traveling alone, I wanted his company. I had it.
"Hello, old man," came his cheery voice as he swung his bag into my carriage. "Here's luck. I was expecting a dull journey."
"Where are you off to?" I asked, discretion still bidding me turn my eyes away, though I saw, without looking, that hers were red-rimmed.
"To old Branbridge's," he answered, shutting the door and leaning out for a last word with his sweetheart.
"Oh, I wish you wouldn't go, John," she was saying in a low, earnest voice. "I feel certain something will happen."
"Do you think I should let anything happen to me, and the day after tomorrow, our wedding day?"
"Don't go," she answered with a pleading intensity which would have sent my Gladstone onto the platform and me after it. But she wasn't speaking to me. John Charrington was made differently. He rarely changed his opinions, never his resolutions. He only stroked the little ungloved hands that lay on the carriage door.
"I must, May. The old boy's been awfully good to me, and now he's dying. I must go and see him, but I shall come home in time."
The rest of the parting was lost in a whisper and in the rattling lurch of the starting train. "You're sure to come?" she spoke as the train moved.
"Nothing shall keep me," he answered,
and we steamed out. After he had seen the last of the little figure on the platform, he leaned back in his corner and kept silence for a minute. When he spoke, it was to explain to me that his godfather, whose heir he was, lay dying at Peasmarsh Place, some 50 miles away, and had sent for John, and John had felt bound to go.
"I shall be surely back tomorrow," he said,
"or if not, the day after, in heaps of time. Thank heaven, one hasn't to get up in the middle of the night to get married nowadays."
"And suppose Mr. Branbridge dies?" "Alive or dead, I mean to be married on Thursday," John answered,
lighting a cigar and unfolding the ties.